Chapter 1976, Where's Reggie? The Game. Baltimore Orioles 1, Boston Red Sox nothing at Memorial Stadium in Baltimore, Maryland. Attendance, 46,425. Friday, April 9th, 1976. The weather, sunny and cool. Hall of Famers, Orioles manager Earl Weaver, pitcher Jim Palmer, and third baseman Brooks Robinson. Red Sox first baseman Carl Yastrzemski, pitcher Ferguson Jenkins, catcher Carlton Fisk, and right fielder Jim Rice. Game highlights. The largest opening day crowd since the St. Louis Browns became the Baltimore Orioles 22 years earlier watched Jim Palmer and Ferguson Jenkins lock horns without giving up an earned run all afternoon. They were so efficient that fans were heading home just 2 hours after the game started. Jenkins went the distance while Palmer got relief help in the ninth from Dyer Miller. Baltimore pushed across the game's only run thanks to two Boston errors in the fourth. Shortstop Rick Burleson's errant throw allowed Lee May to reach base, and he later scored on a single by Bobby Grich when 1975 AL MVP and Rookie of the Year Fred Lynn's throw from center field to third skipped off shortstop Rico Petrocelli, allowing May to score. The story. The stage featured one of the most star-studded Hall of Fame casts of any opening day during the streak, with seven in uniform. On Boston's side of the box score were catcher Carlton Fisk, outfielder Jim Rice, and Carl Yastrzemski, playing first base this day, plus the afternoon starting pitcher, Ferguson Jenkins, all four destined for Cooperstown. For the 20th consecutive year, 39-year-old Brooks Robinson appeared in Baltimore's opening day starting lineup, and for the third straight time, manager Earl Weaver gave the ball to Jim Palmer to begin the season. But it was the future Hall of Famer not yet wearing an Orioles uniform who was drawing the most media attention, Reggie Jackson. Jackson was the biggest name in baseball in the early 70s. I remember one time in 1969 when his Oakland Athletics visited Washington to play the Senators. My dad's law office was above Rinaldi's Cleaners near the White House. After every Senators game, the locker room staff sent the uniforms over for a quick cleaning. One Saturday, Mr. Rinaldi let me try on one jersey from each team, Frank Howard and Reggie Jackson. Both shirts were bigger than I was. The A's visiting grays were vests, so at least my arms showed in the once cherished, now lost, black and white photos. If you were to ask baseball fans from the 1970s and 80s to list the teams for which Reggie Jackson played during his 22 major league seasons, most would quickly recall his early years in Oakland, 1967 to 75. Who he would represent in six All-Star games, and where he was named the AL MVP in 1973. And they'd remember his more lucrative glory days as Mr. October, playing for the New York Yankees 1977 to 81. Both teams later retired his jersey, Oakland, number 9, and the Yankees, number 44. Fans might even remember Jackson's most lucrative twilight years with the California Angels, 1982 to 86, before a final season back in Oakland in 1987. His season as an Angel might have been galvanized in the memory of many by his cameo appearance in the 1988 comedy classic The Naked Gun from the Files of Police Squad with Leslie Nielsen, in which he played himself as a robot programmed to kill Queen Elizabeth II. But ask any fan outside of Baltimore if they remember his time as an Oriole, and the response will likely be, huh? A week before opening day 1976, new Orioles general manager Hank Peters completed a blockbuster trade with the A's to acquire the game's biggest star and the left-handed power his team needed. But it was Oakland's maneuvering in 1976 that garnered far more attention than Baltimore's. In the early 70s, the Athletics were as dominant a team as the game had ever seen, with five straight American League West Division titles from 1971 to 75 and three straight World Series crowns from 72 to 74. Owner Charlie Finley had amassed an all-star roster that would be expensive to maintain. Arbitrator Peter Seitz's landmark ruling in December 1975 meant that by 1977, dozens of players would likely become free agents for the first time. Finley had plenty of these potentially pricey players. Expecting baseball's first bidding war to begin at season's end, the terms of free agency weren't finalized until the new collective bargaining agreement was reached in July. Finley tried to get what he could in return for his biggest stars, determined not to pay top dollar for top talent, a characteristic some suggest lingered with the franchise long after Finley sold the team in 1980. In addition to the Jackson trade, Finley tried to sell stars Joe Rudy, Rolly Fingers, and Vida Blue for cash in June, but the deals were nixed by Commissioner Bowie Kuhn. Oakland's big names in the deal with the Orioles were Jackson and Ken Holtzman. Heading west from Baltimore were pitcher Mike Torres and outfielder Don Baylor, who would later become 1979 AL MVP for the California Angels. Holtzman was already in Baltimore on opening day, set to start the season's second game, but Jackson was a no-show. As of late yesterday, he was still nowhere to be seen, reported Ken Nigro in that morning's Baltimore Sun, preferring to remain in Arizona where he has numerous business interests. "The thought that Reggie might be here any day is encouraging," Weaver told Nigro. "But I've got to worry about the guys who are here. After Jackson or anybody else gets in, then I'll tell them what to do. But I can't do anything about it now. I can't offer him money. My job is to take what's on the club and win with it." Palmer was less diplomatic. "Reggie not being here is psychologically destructive to this ball club," he said. "We give up quality players to get him. If we start the season without him, the first inclination is to ask, why did we make the trade? I would sure like to have Don Baylor playing than no Reggie Jackson. Now we have neither." Jackson's holdout lasted a month. Conventional wisdom suggested it was about money. In part, it was. Jackson had been paid $140,000 in 1975 and was demanding $200,000 for 1976. Finley would have none of that. Reggie's reputation was to stir the pot. In his 1991 book, A Whole Different Ballgame, Marvin Miller revealed a little-known detail about Reggie related to baseball's first-ever player strike in April 1972. After the owners rejected their proposal for binding arbitration, Miller and the MLBPA General Counsel Dick Moss acknowledged privately that time was not right for a strike. They realized a group of ballplayers with no strike fund, who had been without paychecks since the end of the previous season, was in no position to stop working. "The last thing I expected in 1972 was a strike," Miller admitted. But on the flight to Dallas for the executive board meeting, Reggie told the union boss the players he represented did not want to back down. At the meeting, Reggie led the charge. In his 1994 book, Lords of the Realm, John Hyler quotes Reggie's exhortation to his fellow player reps. "God damn it, there are just times when you've got to stand up for your rights." The players voted to strike and won the right to arbitration. Reggie picked fights with Finley in Oakland and later made headlines in New York for his dust-ups with manager Billy Martin and owner George Steinbrenner. And while Baltimore's Weaver had a fiery temper, in Peters and Hofberger, Jackson could not find a suitable sparring partner. To his credit, Peters coddled the oversized ego for a month and landed the prize in Baltimore for most of one season. According to baseball broadcaster and historian Phil Wood, years later, Peters admitted, quote, "The biggest mistake he made in Baltimore was not giving Reggie Jackson what he wanted in a long-term deal. $1.25 million for 5 years. It would have been the biggest bargain in baseball." When he arrived in town, Jackson said all the right things. "I was never informative and probably was a real pain in the butt to talk with," Jackson admitted. "I never met anybody quite like Hank Peters and Jerry Hofberger. It was the consistency of their interest, their humaneness, sensitivity, and fairness, and continually leaving the door open that made me come here without a signed contract." So what took 4 weeks? Probably it took me that long to realize it. They won me over as nice guys. No wonder Reggie lasted only 5 months in Charm City. For box scores, play-by-play, Reggie's Sabre.org bio, and more, visit openingday5050.com.